Good morning and welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As some federal legislators move to stifle salmon recovery in science, Columbia Riverkeeper recently released new research on how the Snake River dams affect water temperature and salmon migration. In 2015, hot water killed 250,000 sockeye salmon in the Columbia River Basin. Despite the record-breaking temperatures and fish kills that year, Columbia Riverkeeper's study reveals that the lower Snake River would have remained cool enough to support salmon migration if the lower four Snake River dams had been removed. This morning, we talk with Brett VandenHeuvel, who's Columbia Riverkeeper's executive director, about current efforts in Congress to block federal agencies from taking court-mandated steps to help endangered salmon migrate past these dams. And we'll hear what Columbia Riverkeeper is doing to counter these salmon-killing measures. Brett, welcome to Luck is Focus.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
So you put out the study, about 6 weeks ago, I think? And at the time, very few of us had heard about this legislative action that's pending in the Congress, the U.S. Congress, to basically undo, it seems like, 30, 40 years of work to try to get rid of the Snake River dams. So I wanted to start by talking about what these dams are and why so many people who are advocates for salmon health want those dams removed.
Yeah, so the Columbia and Snake River systems have, you know, multiple dams, and they're large hydroelectric dams. This lower Snake River dams, and the Snake River flows into the Columbia, you know, near the Tri-Cities in south central Washington. These dams are a particular problem, and for decades, you know, a lot of biologists and scientists have advocated for their removal. It's over in the high desert where the air temperatures are warm and there's less shade, and these dams have created giant heat-absorbing reservoirs that really warm up the water temperature, and salmon need cool water. Not only that, they block, they make it more difficult for salmon to migrate, while there's fish ladders where the adults can pass through. You know, but there's a lot of mortality associated with passing through dams, and the juvenile salmon coming down from their headwater streams to the ocean also have trouble passing dams. So there's a lot of really wonderful intact habitat in Idaho that these dams are really blocking. So in order to restore some of the runs of sockeye and other fish that could in some ways thrive in this wilderness habitat, the dams are causing a huge problem to the fish reaching that habitat.
Now, there's four dams on the Columbia River, the main stem, prior to reaching the Snake River. So what is the difference between the four dams on the Columbia River and the four dams on the lower Snake in terms of salmon health?
Well, all dams are harmful for salmon, and all dams are blocking salmon. Part of the calculus of scientists over the years has just been political, where the dams on the main stem Columbia does not seem feasible to remove in any time in the near future. They're used for transportation of barges going up and down the river, so that's part of it. And the four lower Snake River dams also allow for transportation, but it's a lot less heavily used. It's basically going up to the Port of Lewiston, which is the furthest in-water port in the world. And so those Snake River dams aren't as critical to our region-wide transportation as some would say the main stem dams are. The other difference is that there's, you know, that's so far upriver that these salmon have traveled for thousands of years, you know, and have adapted to travel that far, but it's difficult. And once we throw dams in their way, it makes it even more difficult. So the salmon that are swimming all the way up, like sockeye, for example, that are swimming and spawning in lakes in Idaho, are, that's difficult enough to begin with. And once you put these dams in their way, these runs are really right on the edge of extinction. So the biological reason is, if we don't remove these four Snake River dams, we're going to lose populations of salmon.
Well, as far as the usefulness of them, and you didn't mention, there's also the issue of how much electricity they generate. What's the difference in the electrical output of the Snake River dams as opposed to the four main stem dams on the Columbia River?
Yeah, the four lower Snake River dams are much smaller power producers than, say, the dams that, you know, people closer to Portland are more familiar with Bonneville and the Dalles Dam and John Day, McNary, which is out by Umatilla. So it's a much different scale of power production. Some of the largest, you know, Grand Coulee is obviously very big in northern Washington, but some of the largest hydroelectric dams in the United States are located on the main stem. And on the Snake River, it's much, much less power production. And we're in a time, you know, where it's people sometimes are pitting, well, dams are renewable energy and they're carbon-free. But there's really exciting advances in renewable energy right now. And, you know, someday we're going to have large-scale renewable production that will hopefully replace the power that's currently produced by the dams.
Well, I understand, and you know this as a fact, when there have been these times when the river is really running high, and at the same time the wind is blowing a lot, and so rather than shut down the dams, and in fact, I guess I understand you can't just start spilling that willy-nilly when there's a high water flow. So they shut down the windmills generation. And I heard from somebody, at least the last time this happened, that the same amount of power that they had to take away, they had to turn off from the windmills, was the amount of electricity that's generated by the four Snake River dams. And if they just stopped those dams, we wouldn't have had this power glut, and we could have just, you know, the windmills could have continued to flow or continue to spin. Do you know for a fact that that's true, that that's about the amount of electricity that's generated by the Snake River dams?
I don't know for sure in that situation, but yes, there are times where, you know, that we have a complicated grid in the Northwest, and it's controlled by Bonneville Power Association. Some of the, you know, the flow of this electricity, and at times the wind is, you know, at times certain power sources are producing too much along with the dam. So, yeah, I don't know that exact situation, but that definitely happens.
Yeah, well, it seems to make sense that when we have a glut of power, and this is one of the interesting things about the Northwest, that very often the same time that we have so much water flowing through, particularly in the late winter, early spring, is also a time of high winds in the gorge, and that a rational system would look at it and go, well, don't we want to have more hydro, have more wind power than use hydro and start to curtail on the dams? But instead, there's this old thinking, which I guess is what you're up against and what we'll talk more about in the show, that the dams are in place. In fact, I think that George W. Bush's administration said the dams were part of nature now, and so they have to be figured as the nature. And these windmills are just these upstarts, and, you know, people can't quite wrap their brains around them. So I think that there's a mindset that really needs to be shifting, and I wonder how you see that might be happening.
Yeah. I think this hot water crisis on the Columbia and the Snake Rivers provides an interesting frame for that. You know, the dams are warming up the river, or have warmed up the river, and when you add climate change and record temperatures and the continued trend of our temperature going up, the result is a Columbia River that's too hot for salmon to survive. And that's a choice we have to make. You know, we're really faced with it. It's flown under the radar a bit, but scientists are recognizing this. That we have a choice of doing something about the Columbia and Snake River's water temperature, which is too hot for salmon survival, or allowing them to go extinct. And that's a very stark way of looking at it. Are we willing to sacrifice salmon as a species, and definitely certain populations of them, in order to continue on with business as usual? Or maybe this could force some, you know, more aggressive changes and more shifting away from the status quo because we value salmon so much. It's such a huge part of our economy, you know, billions of dollars a year, and we're not willing to sacrifice those.
Well, I'm thinking about, again, this status quo of the dams and how there's, you mentioned that they are important for navigation and for all the barges, that particularly the ones that carry wheat, and they also carry fossil fuels, oil in particular, and they carry garbage up the river from Vancouver, Washington. But that it's the barge industry, and Bonneville Dam for that, or the Bonneville Power Administration, and a lot of other vested interests talk about we need to have these dams for transportation. And I had this very interesting experience about 15 years ago. I rode the Tidewater barge up to the Dalles Dam to get a sense for a radio documentary I was doing about the industrialization of the Columbia River. I was trying to get a ride all the way up to Lewiston, and I was told by Tidewater Barge, well, we only have a handful of barges a month that go up to Lewiston. Most of them only go up to Pasco. So right there, I thought, there's an admission that we don't need those dams. And I was hearing it from the port captain of Tidewater Barge. However, that's not anything that they would ever come out and say publicly. They wouldn't join in with Columbia Riverkeeper in calling for the dams to be removed. So how do we kind of break our way through that status quo thinking and kind of get to the underlying truths of the fact that these dams really don't amount to much and are basically, their main function right now is to kill salmon?
Yeah, so the four Lower Snake River dams, I mean, that number of not many barges going up to Lewiston, there's even less and less barges going to Lewiston for other economic factors. There's some additional rail shipment of wheat and other products that is a substitute for the barges, so it's not like the wheat shipments would have to stop. You know, there's other ways to get wheat to the market, and there's increasing rail ability to do that. So, you know, I think some of it is inertia, and obviously, if you're the Port of Lewiston, you want to stay open, and they're going to fight to stay open with that vested interest. But again, I think taking a bigger, broader look, and it'd be great to have some federal leadership on this that could make some of these challenging decisions and recognize that our salmon economy is so valuable, not to mention, you know, protecting endangered species is the right thing to do, and tribal treaty rights that have guaranteed the right to catch salmon from our federal government to several tribes. All of these things point to a real need to reevaluate and take a hard look at dam removal for the Lower Snake River dams. And there are alternatives. You know, in fact, over time, the economy is going to improve as we continue to ship wheat on trains and by other ways and restore salmon.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Brett Vandenhoevel, who is the executive director of Columbia Riverkeeper, who has been fighting for, you can tell me how many years, Brett, to basically restore the Columbia River from some very degraded conditions that it's been in for a long time. And part of the mission, I mean, a lot, we've been talking with Columbia Riverkeeper for the last couple of years about stopping oil trains and coal trains and stopping the fossil fuel industry from getting a foothold, very strong foothold in the Northwest. But one of the things about we started your organization was protecting salmon. Is that true?
Yeah, so salmon have always been a big focus. I mean, our mission is to protect the water quality of the Columbia and all life connected to it. And, you know, that includes salmon are a huge part of that, and fish and wildlife, and the communities along the river that depend on clean water. So we actually, the organization formed around in the late 80s under a different name for Hanford when they were shipping barges of nuclear waste up and down the Columbia. But that's a different topic.
Actually, we're going to get onto that topic in a few weeks.
So I'll leave that there. But I just can't emphasize enough how important this threat of hot water is to salmon right now. Salmon can't survive. Well, salmon, the state scientists have set a standard of 68 degrees Fahrenheit, as anything above that is, you know, not safe for salmon. And the Columbia regularly gets 72, 73 degrees here in the gorge where I live, and it's just too hot for migrating salmon. And in 2015, it was a very dramatic example of that, where we had really hot weather early in June, which may become the norm as climate change takes hold in the Northwest, and 250,000 sockeye salmon died as they were trying to migrate upstream. And for that Snake River run that we were talking about, specifically those sockeye that were headed to the Snake River, 96% of that run was killed by hot water. And so, you know, that run was already imperiled, and soon hot water could be the absolute death knell of that salmon run. And so we have a situation where it was probably the only time in, you know, at least recorded human history that human-caused pollution turned back a salmon run. That's never happened before. In this case, it was heat pollution. If that had been oil, or if it had been mercury or something, you know, that was more dramatic, I think there would be outrage about that. But because it's this insidious problem of temperature, it's flying under the radars. And unfortunately, our federal officials, under the Trump administration and even previous administrations, really weren't doing enough about it to address some of these problems.
Well, actually, I was just thinking about back in 1980 when Mount St. Helens erupted. There was some talk about it. I think it might have hurt some of the salmon runs on the Cowlitz River. But in fact, it seemed like the difference between that kind of catastrophic event and the heat, and we also should get to this summer, which is another bizarrely hot summer with some other catastrophic events as well, that the salmon found alternative routes, which is what they're very good at, but there's no alternative route to the main stem Columbia.
Right, right. And things like volcanoes, you know, obviously aren't human-caused, and there's been volcanoes during the, as salmon have evolved, and there's been other big events where there's put a lot of sediment in the river, and, you know, they survive those things. Usually those are temporary in nature, where it might knock down the population for a little while, and then the water starts to flow more clearly, or they have, like you say, alternative, you know, they figure out their ways. Dams are a different story. They're large impediments in the river. They've radically changed the flow in the ecosystem, and they've done it on a really rapid scale. And there aren't alternatives. You know, you think about the main stem Columbia through in the Pacific Northwest, you know, the Columbia River Basin is the size of France. It serves every single one of those fish that are migrating back to the headwaters throughout the basin need to come through a very narrow one location. And so it's absolutely critical to protect that. Unfortunately, a lot of that habitat has already been lost. You know, the Grand Coulee Dam blocks salmon migration above northern Washington, so huge amount of habitat in British Columbia has been lost already, as well as from dams in Idaho. But we can restore. The tribes are several tribal nations are doing an amazing job restoring habitat and further upstream. And we just need to make sure the fish can get there. That's not going to help.
Well, there's been like a lot of talk for many, many years for getting rid of those four Snake River dams, or just breaching them. I don't even know if it means taking them out. Can we talk a little bit about how the sort of the progress that has made, and then what kind of obstacles that mindset is hitting right now?
Yeah. Well, like you said, scientists have been talking about this for a long time, as those salmon runs have declined. During the Clinton administration, Bruce Babbitt, who was Secretary of the Interior, raised this as a viable alternative. And it was actually, you know, evaluated and explored. These things take time. It didn't happen in the 80s. Subsequent administrations didn't, take this as a priority or focus on it. And it's essentially languished, and the dam removal efforts have languished, despite really great effort from many conservation groups along the way. There's been some coalitions that have formed, like Save Wild Salmon Coalition, that have been pushing for this for a long time and just haven't got through the political roadblocks. As many people are aware, there's long-running litigation challenging the hydropower system and the impact on endangered species. There's been a series of what they call biological opinions, which are the federal agencies have to evaluate whether the dams are jeopardizing these endangered and threatened salmon. And as a result of some of this litigation, dam removal of the four lower Snake River dams should be considered, and it is back on the table. We're not very hopeful the Trump administration is going to take a hard look at that and do the necessary work, but I think the science is clear. It's just political roadblocks right now stopping this from moving forward.
I mean, there's been a judge, I don't remember his name, who has several times come down with decisions that basically threw out the salmon recovery plans. I know it was from the Clinton administration, actually. Their plan was thrown out. George W. Bush's plans were thrown out several times. And even the Obama administration's plans were thrown out. And every time, my recollection of this is, every time they were thrown back to, like, you have to consider taking out the four Snake River dams. So what is the mechanism that keeps these decisions being basically the same decision each time, but an administration trying to find some workaround so they don't have to take the dams out?
Yeah, well, the mechanism is they've come back multiple times, the federal government, and said, you know, okay, here's our plan this time, and then the courts have, you know, we have courts that are looking at it more objectively than the federal government is, and the courts have rejected that over and over and over, and we're hopeful that the courts have, you know, had enough of this. They keep writing very strong opinions and saying you need to consider other things instead of the status quo. And right now it's been once again remanded back to the federal government, and they're in the process of, putting together a new plan. So I'm as frustrated about this as anybody. It's not working to continue to just put forward these inefficient and ineffective plans and have them turned back by the court, but you know that's how our system is designed right now, and especially during the Trump administration now taking a new shot at these plans, it's incredibly frustrating.
Well, I was thinking about when Obama became president, and he was probably the most intelligent president we'd had in many years. But when he was talking about the whole salmon issue, I think I'm not sure he was in the Northwest when he spoke about it, but he used it as an example of the confusing government bureaucracies, because there were so many different agencies that dealt with salmon. And listening to his remarks, it made me think he doesn't understand what anadromous fish is. He didn't understand that salmon spend time in the ocean, they spend time in the rivers. And so while we have different agencies for river management and ocean management, obviously the salmon overseeing is going to be done by different agencies. And I thought, if Obama doesn't understand the basic biology of anadromous fish, we're in trouble, because, I mean, he's the smartest president we probably had in many, many years. Certainly, we don't have a president our current president doesn't even understand the geography of where Puerto Rico is. So obviously, he doesn't understand ocean science. So I'm wondering, I mean, is that a big problem, that there's like not a lot of understanding at high federal levels about the complications of salmon biology and salmon life histories?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated system, and it's a complicated regulatory system. It's multiple states are involved. We draw these political boundaries where the river, the river doesn't care what state it's in or or what federal agency is managing it at that point. What's supposed to happen is the Endangered Species Act is supposed to transcend all of this. you know, that's why we have federal legislation that's designed to protect species that are about to go extinct and force some actions to protect those species before they go extinct. And then we have other federal laws like the Clean Water Act that is designed to set a standard, okay, the water can't be higher than 68 degrees, and force all of these disparate regulatory agencies, be they state or federal government, it forces them to all meet that level. But it takes enforcement. You know, we can have laws on paper that are good, but if they're not enforced, then they're worthless. And so that's one thing that Riverkeeper and some of our partners are trying to do is we filed the first lawsuit against Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the EPA, when he first came in February, and saying, you're not taking action to reduce temperature, and you have an obligation to do that, and we're going to try to use the law to force you to do that. So there's the law on paper, there's the confusion on paper, but that's why we need courts and why we're trying to be aggressive in the legal system right now. And I do think there's a bit of, you know, the Pacific Northwest is somewhat removed from the halls of power of Washington, D.C., and people don't understand the geography and the importance of salmon and the importance to our economy. And, you know, I also think it's our senators and congresspeople need to do a better job of advocating for that as well.
Well, how are our Congress people doing, particularly in light of this legislation that's being proposed in the House, which maybe we should talk a bit about what that is and how that is like really contrary to the direction that we thought the understanding of salmon protection and restoration of the Columbia River system was going prior to Trump?
Yeah. So, you know, there's been a bill introduced in the House, it's 3144, that would essentially roll back the efforts to restore salmon. It would block federal agencies from taking court-mandated steps to help endangered salmon migrate past the dams.
Now, what does that mean exactly?
It would say, basically, you know, that the courts have realized that the federal government is not complying with the Endangered Species Act, and the courts have the power to say you have to comply. But if Congress changes that, it would essentially scrap parts of the Endangered Species Act specific to the Columbia River. I mean, it wouldn't change the Endangered Species Act, but it would prohibit them from even studying whether to remove the lower Four Snake River dams. So what we see is a reaction. The courts have said, you know, salmon may go extinct unless you remove these dams, so you need to at least consider that. And we have some legislators that are stepping in and saying, whoa, we're going to block the opinion of scientists and courts and say you can't even evaluate removing the lower Snake River dams, which is a huge problem. That was introduced by Representative McMorris Rogers in Washington, Representative Kurt Schrader in Oregon, and some others.
Okay, so we can do something about it because Kurt Schrader is, I don't think he's your representative. Actually, yours is Greg Wald. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But, I mean, Kurt Schrader is the representative for lots of people who are listening right now. And I'd like to know how he could become so misled that he is co-sponsoring this legislation.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's this legislation is disappointing. You know, as a 501c3 organization, Riverkeeper does not engage in electoral politics and has limits on lobbying and things like that. So we really focus on more of the advocacy side. But this legislation is certainly, if it passes, and even the thought of trying to interfere like this certainly has a big impact on trying to recover salmon.
I'm just wondering about people, because I'm just thinking about all the listeners we have who live in Clackamas County. Actually, I got an email from a person who's been very involved with KBOO for a long time, who's currently living in Nehalem, she lives in his district, and she's been writing a flurry of letters to the local local newspaper, and also to Kurt Schrader, and I was very happy to see someone like her living in his district. But it seems like if he got enough response from his constituents, that this is really going in the wrong direction, and trying to get a rationale from him of why are you doing this. I wonder if that could put some pressure on him to pull out of this, because it's just horrifying to me that somebody who, I mean, I would say that he's a funny kind of Democrat. He's certainly not a Democrat in the mold of the rest of our Oregon delegation. But it seems like he could listen to his constituents if they came together with a strong voice. And I'm wondering how to help shape that voice.
Yeah. For any issue, pressure on our electeds, or having them hear from people, is really important. They regularly doing town halls and forums, and I think they're getting, we see this over and over where legislators are getting pressure from lobbyists and others with financial interests, where they're not hearing enough from their constituents, or they're maybe not listening enough to their constituents. And so elevating some of these issues through letters, through town halls, through any of those communications is really important. And like I said, this salmon issue is flying under the radar. It may be something we look back at and say, well, why didn't we do something about that when we had a chance? And now is the time when we have a chance.
Well, I'm just thinking about ways to get the word out. And for one thing, you've got a lot of stuff about this on your website, I believe, on Columbia Riverkeeper website.
Yeah, on Columbia Riverkeeper's website and our Facebook page, and we push out and track some of these bills and some of the actions that are happening. It's following everything that's happening in Washington D.C. can drive you insane, but we have a particular focus on actions that are affecting the Columbia.
So where would people go to find out more information? And is there like a template for taking action on your website?
So ColumbiaRiverkeeper.org, and probably the best way is to, we have different, petitions and actions we take. If folks, sign up to receive those, there's an opportunity on the front page to sign up to receive action alerts, and we can keep people posted, and then we can tailor it to what people are most interested in as well.
So we'll have a link on the Locus Focus website so people can go there and find out how to get more involved. I'm thinking about all the outpouring at the town hall meetings last winter, right after Trump became president. And it was focused on mostly a lot of national issues. And people were out in droves. I went to a Jeff Merkley meeting where there, I don't know how many thousands of people there, spilling out. There were as many people outside waiting, outside listening, as there were inside this cafetorium that we were in. I'd like to see that same kind of energy directed at Kurt Schrader, and for those of you in Washington. And who's the Washington representative who's sponsored the bill?
It's Kathy McMorris Rogers.
Okay, so those two people in particular in this region, that when they have their town halls, that you go to those town halls and this is a question that you bring up, as opposed to, it's because I think it's just as important as talking about health care. It's just as important as talking about immigration. I mean, this is basically the lifeblood of our region. And as you said, it's flying under the radar, and it would be really too bad to wake up in 20 years and go, well, we blew this chance to like really save the salmon.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some of the strongest efforts now to waive the protections of salmon. I think the industry and some elected officials are realizing that we're at a real turning point right here, where we can't continue to just submit study after study. At some point, there needs to be a decision of whether to move forward with actual, real protections of salmon and restoring these runs, or to try to, make loopholes in the laws that would allow them to go extinct. And those decisions are very important right now and are going to affect us in the future. So it is time to come together and push for for protecting salmon.
I'm just curious how you feel. Like, how would you compare your sense of hope in terms of being able to really strengthen salmon protection to move forward in that direction compared to the kinds of success that your group and a lot of other groups are having in probably stopping the Northwest from becoming a major fossil fuel export hub?
Yeah, that's a great question, and they're connected. You know, I mean, one of the reasons people are standing up to coal and oil and gas is to protect water quality and protect aquatic life and salmon. Those are much more, you know, we along with many allies, Riverkeeper along with many, many allies, have set records for the amount of public turnout for hearings and the most comments. You know, on oil and gas, we've submitted over 1 million public comments. And so it's been this absolutely incredible, record-breaking exhibit of democracy, of people really standing up to protect something. And the results have been fantastic, where elected leaders have actually listened and are denying permits. For something like the hot water crisis on the Columbia, you know, we're not seeing that kind of that as aggressive as a response. It's not as big into the public consciousness right now, and part of that, I think, is our fault as conservation groups. We haven't done a good enough job of ringing the bell about this and really promoting it. And it's also, you know, probably not as visceral as a coal train storming through your community. Hot water is, you know, it's something people jump in the river, it feels good, but not if you're a salmon and can't breathe. So I think we have to, I think it's going to take a whole nother level of effort. It is a real crisis right now, and I'm hopeful that we can use some of the momentum from some of these more visceral fights from the fossil fuels and be able to transition some of that into these more difficult, longer-term fights like restoring water quality and cool, free-flowing water onto the Columbia.
Well, I'm wondering if part of the problem with raising consciousness about the hot water issue comes from the fact, comparing it with the fossil fuel threat, that we are used to what we have, and so one of the reasons why there's such opposition to turning this region into a fossil fuel export hub is we don't want it to be that way because we love it the way it is. But for most people my age and your age, we came into the Northwest in a landscape of dams. And in fact, I mean, I came here in 71, and they were still building the dams on the Snake River, actually, when I was first living here. And it was kind of interesting. Nobody was, like, that I was aware of was questioning it. And I sort of saw the Bonneville Dam in particular and the Dells Dam as, like, part of the landscape. You know, it was like, I knew that they were built in the 30s and then in the 50s, but it's still, it seemed normal to me. And it took a really long time. It took actually learning about Celilo Falls and learning about the Cascades, the rapids, and the historic salmon runs to understand how unnatural these dams were. But I wonder how we get people to, I mean, one of the things that I was trying to do with some of the documentaries I've done is like to peel back the landscape so we can see it before it was industrialized, and for people to understand what the great power potential of nature is in this region and how much we've mucked it up. And I'm wondering if we do that, if we can get people fired up about the fact, no, the Columbia River shouldn't be 72 degrees running through the gorge in the summer. And so also, I remember 2 years ago, there was a lot of talk about those salmon kills and maybe the images of all the, I mean, unfortunately, those salmon disappeared, didn't they? It wasn't like a big kill like in the Klamath River a few years ago.
You know, those sockeye, we would see them swimming around in circles in some of the tributaries that were cooler water, just waiting to die. You know, so it wasn't the dramatic images of a lot of the fish, like on the Klamath, washed up on the beaches. You know, a lot of them sank or were just holing up in these tributaries. There's some really dramatic videos. We have some on the Riverkeeper website of these fish with lesions on them that are so stressed from hot water. They just couldn't, you know, their DNA, every ancestral desire in their bodies to get upstream to spawn, and they've been doing this for thousands of years. And these fish literally turned around and came back downstream and found these cool waters to swim in circles and die. And so, you know, for those of us who saw that, it is incredibly sad and disappointing. But yeah, it is harder to capture images and to make this as a visual impact for hot water. And as far as the dams, being here, you're right. I mean, most of us, it's kind of a part of daily life. But they haven't been here forever. And it's not even dam removal that we're necessarily talking about on the main stem for Bonneville and the Dalles Dam and those other and several other dams. It's there can be changes in the operation and configuration of those dams that would help a great deal. So by that meaning more flow over the dams in the spring to create more of natural flows. While we're never if the dams are there, it's never going to be completely natural, but we can maximize some of the flow for salmon migration as opposed to maximizing it only for hydropower.
Actually happening for a while. I mean, and in fact, I remember that they redid the fish ladders, definitely on the Bonneville, maybe on the Dalles Dam, to make them actually more in keeping with what salmon's needs are as they go over rapids. So, I mean, do you know much about that? If that really has, if there were definite changes that enhance salmon migration?
Yeah, there's been changes that have improved it. The main thing has been what they call spill, which is more flow over the dams to allow juvenile to get down. And some of that spill was ordered by the courts in response to some of the lawsuits we've been talking about. And we've had larger runs, and it's probably contributed to it. Those spills were a few years ago. Those fish go out to the ocean for 2-3 years, and then there's been larger runs coming back. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what it's been because there's many factors like ocean conditions that impact that, but those additional spills, I think spill is a terrible word, but they're essentially spilling water like it's a bad thing over the dams instead of having it run through the turbines, and that's good for the juvenile fish to get down. As far as the fish ladders, yeah, there's been some changes so the adult fish can get up, but none of these are really designed with the temperature problem in mind. The temperature of the water continues to rise, and there's some fish passage issues where it can get better, but if we're going to stop this increase in the hot water, we need to take some more aggressive action.
Well, actually, I remember a few years ago there was talk about possibly decommissioning John Day Dam because it has the worst fish ladders. They barely function. It's the highest dam, and I think it generates the least electricity. So I'm wondering if anybody's still talking about taking that dam out and if that would help in terms of the hot water.
I don't think there's serious conversations among the powers that be to take the John Day Dam out. The John Day is, you're right, it's a huge, the John Day Reservoir is a huge problem. It's extremely hot water and adds a lot of heat to the system. And you mentioned the repairs. I mean, the cost of these dams and the repair of them is astronomical. And when you look at some of the Snake River dams in particular, the amount of cost that's going in to repair them versus the benefits. And think about how old the dams are. The dams are now, the Dalles Dam is, 57 years old. Bonneville is older than that. And so there's reaching the point in their life cycle where there's a lot of needs for repair that are going to continue to add cost. And so if they're just looking at the power produced, that's not a fair analysis. It needs to be, what are the overall costs of maintaining these dams over the long term? And once you start crunching those numbers, It really opens up serious conversations about different steps forward.
Oh, I'm just thinking about footage that I've seen of Celilo Falls, and I wonder if they had this movie they showed at the Discovery Center right outside of the Dalles, and they were showing this. This was 15 years ago when I saw it, but just this amazing footage of Indian fishermen fishing at Celilo Falls, and I think anybody who sees actual footage and hears the roar of Celilo Falls would call for pulling out all the dams on the Columbia River. I wonder if we can do more education in that respect too, to get people to really imagine what this landscape was like without the dams and the value of it in its natural state.
Yeah. I mean, I spend a lot of time out on the river, and it's especially here in the gorge, you know, it's essentially a series of reservoirs, big lakes, and then it's pinned in both sides with railroads and, you know, the ballast and riprap that's associated with that. So there's, you know, straight edges, very little riparian vegetation, no flow. It's a completely unnatural system versus, you know, what it would have been. I mean, one of the greatest rivers in the world flowing down with these massive spring torrents and sandbars and shifting sediment. And it wasn't that long ago. It's certainly, yeah, some of that old footage is really inspiring. It's also very painful. You know, there's been some talk of, well, why don't we, you know, lower the Dalles Dam and allow Celilo to fall for a couple of days a week and or a couple of days a year. And, you know, a lot of Native American elders and others have said they don't want that. You know, it's been such a painful thing to bring it back for just a little while. It would be, incredibly painful. So there's a lot of different cultural and you know, physical factors with this. But I think the bottom line for us is the four lower Snake River dams are going to cause extinction soon, and we should be in the process of figuring out how to remove them, how to get that wheat down on trains and other ways. And the main stem dams, you know, are more challenging situation right now.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Brett Vandenhoevel, who is the director of Columbia Riverkeeper. We're talking about the hot water problem in the Columbia River system, and particularly caused by the Snake River dams, the lower four Snake River dams. For the remaining part of this program, I actually want to move on to another subject that's been really important this summer. This has been another very hot summer, very different from 2015. In fact, as I kind of remember with this summer with a shudder, I still remember that 2015 was worse, I mean, in terms of like extensive heat. But there were certainly, we had an extensive heat, and then we had this horrible fire in the gorge. And so there's two parts to my remaining questions. The first one is, what do you expect possibly to see in terms of returning salmon runs as a result of this summer? And were there as many fish kills as there were in 2015?
Yes, it's been a hot summer, as they all are, seem to be, when we're having, you know, many of the summers now among the top 10 hottest years on record, which has become the new norm. We didn't have the fish kills like in 2015, primarily because the 2015 were sockeye, which migrate earlier in June. And in 2015, we had really hot 100-degree days in June, which the sockeye just aren't, you know, they're not adapted to that warmer water. So fortunately, it was cooler in June this year.
And except for that 100-degree day, we did have one. But.
But the fish runs have been down, and particularly some steelhead runs, some sockeye runs have been down this year, and the runs fluctuate. You know, historically, before the dams came in, there were 30 million salmon that would migrate up there. We're at a fraction of that now. You know, we might be at 10% of that, and they fluctuate. Some years are better than others, and it's not always an easy correlation between, oh, the river's hot this year, we're going to have lower runs, because, you know, we've got a lot of interesting and problematic things happening in the ocean as well. And so, but to answer your question, fortunately, it's been we haven't had the massive fish die-offs, which is good, but the runs have been, it hasn't been a very good year for salmon.
Well, as we're talking, I'm just remembering this is like the second week in October, and this is usually when I go out to Eagle Creek and watch the fall Chinook runs return and spawn. I'm not going to be doing that this year. I don't think I can get there anyway. But I'm just wondering, what's your thought in terms of the fall runs and the fire and the impact of the fire on all those tributary streams in the western part of the gorge?
Yeah. I mean, the fish are back. The fish are, I just saw some video from Eagle Creek where there's fish in Eagle Creek. I think the biggest impact is going to be the sediment. Is, you know, the fish need clear gravel and they're laying their eggs, and if that gets covered up by sediment, then that can smother those eggs. And so if we have a lot of erosion and sediment pouring into those streams this winter because the trees are gone, you know, that's gonna harm those eggs. You know, in the grand scheme of things, in the bigger system, there's not a huge amount of habitat in that area. You know, the Eagle Creek, for example, are going, those fish, a lot of them are going back to the hatchery. And there's waterfalls that, you know, come down from the gorge walls. So it's not like those fish are traveling up a long ways through those systems. So there will be probably some mortality of you know, the juveniles that are coming out of there and the eggs from sediment, but hopefully that won't be too big of a problem. It shouldn't affect the main stem a lot. And if people want to see salmon, they're in the rivers. And I know some of those gorge trails are closed, but it's always an inspiring thing to see it on the Washington side. You know, everything is still open. The Klickitat River is a great place to see people catching salmon, some of the Native American fishers. I was just out on the Hood River yesterday, and there's a lot of salmon spawning in the Hood River. So it is, it's worth trying to get out and enjoy and see some of those really amazing fish.
So can people go to that, it's the section where I see the most salmon spawning in Eagle Creek was like right by the large parking lot. Just up from that, when you first get off the freeway. So is that open for people to be able to go? Of course, the bridge is gone, right? That bridge burnt down.
I think that's closed.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure, but I would have to guess.
Actually, I saw a photograph of that bridge. you wouldn't want to walk across it. So, and that you really need to go across the bridge in order to see it. So I guess that's closed. But I guess we'll go over to Washington this year.
Yeah.
Well, one last thing I want to bring up before that we have to close the show today. This is another fear from Washington. What do you know about Greg Walden's plans to pass a bill that would suspend all the protections in the Columbia River Gorge, in the gorge area, and particularly in the wilderness part of the gorge, so that they can do salvage logging after the fire?
Yeah, it's a really disappointing bill. Introduced by Representative Walden.
I think Wyden's against it.
It's a classic salvage rider bill that people have done in the past. They're trying to use the fire as a, you know, an excuse to do some more logging, and so it would waive protections of endangered species. It would waive the environmental impact statement requirement of, you know, for large projects. It's not what we need right now. You know, it'll be pushed under the guise of doing restoration work, but the fire was awful, and as someone who had to stay inside with their 4 and 6 year old for a couple of weeks, I just, you know, that little impact of me, I felt it every day, not to mention, you know, some of my coworkers that were evacuated from Cascade Locks and all the terrible, terrible human problems with the fire and the smoke and the health issues, and then obviously the ecological damage. But, you know, the fires burn and the forest will be resilient. It'll restore itself, and we need to allow it to do that and not go in and log it. And there's going to be this broader effort to, you know, there's a national bill called the Westerman Bill that would essentially waive some protections nationally in fire situation. And we can't politicize this. We need to let forests restore themselves, and we can't allow, you know, additional logging to go in and cause more erosion to harm the forest when our main focus should be restoring the gorge.
Well, I remember after the Dollar Lake fire up in Mount Hood, on the north face of Mount Hood, I think that was 5 years ago, and I went hiking up there the year after the fire, and there are signs everywhere that said, this is a wilderness area, no logging. And it was really wonderful to see that, because I'd spent a lot of time down in the Biscuit Burn and covered that whole struggle to try to stop the salvage logging there. Or let's call it post-fire logging, because it's not salvaging anything. And it was very interesting. I thought, well, we've made a lot of progress, because nobody's talking about coming in and taking out all the snags here, which were amazing, and the live trees. It seems like this is all part of this step backward with the Trump administration, that Walden would have the audacity to propose to log in such a sacred area as the Columbia River Gorge.
Yeah, I mean, it's very disappointing, and hopefully it will be a glimmer of hope that people will come together to continue to protect the gorge. I know there's a lot of people, particularly in Portland, that were, you know, deeply affected. Their favorite places, these places that are so ingrained in us, we've been back to over and over, and people wanting to do something. What can we do to you know, protect this area? And really, for the fire, there wasn't a lot people could do, you know, and I know that was really frustrating for people, but maybe now this is the opportunity to say, to actually stand up for long-term protection, not allow logging, allow the forest to regenerate itself, and not just within the National Scenic Area, but like you're saying, you know, some of the wilderness areas and beyond in the National Forest that were burned pretty, that there were some areas of severe burning, but going in there and, you know, building more roads and logging is not going to help the forest.
And also, we don't need probably to go in and plant very many trees either. I know people are talking about going out and planting trees, and I tell them, no, forests regenerate themselves if you leave them alone.
Yeah, and these west side forests are different. You know, a lot of the fires we see are on the drier side or the east side, and on the wetter side, there's talk of a lot about, oh, if we don't manage these forests, they're going to continue to burn, and that's just not the case. Especially on the wet side, you know, clear cutting. I mean, if you paved all the forest, yes, and giant parking lots, they would not burn. But clear cuts are bad for forest fire. You know, they grow very thick, and in future years, they cause even hotter and worse fires. Old growth forests are the most resistant to fires. And so the more we can allow these forests to grow and be forests and not overly manage them, which is often a euphemism for cutting them, the better off we're going to be. So there's not a lot of restoration tree planting opportunities, in part because they're going to try to restore it more naturally. And then the other part, you know, it's the Forest Service, and volunteering with them is not always the easiest thing in the world, and they have some liability issues. But, yes, enjoy the forest, try to get out and appreciate them, and push back on logging bills.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Brad. It's been really good talking to you. I've been wanting to do it for years, so I'm glad we did it this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. I really appreciate it. You do a fantastic job. I enjoy the show.
Thank you. Well, we'll be talking this morning with Brett Vandenhoevel, who is Columbia Riverkeepers Executive Director. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we talk with Richard Heimberg about going 100% renewable. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with a little smidge of music by Milton Nascimento, the Miracle of the Fishes. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Eu vejo esses peixes se for de coração. Eu vejo essas marcas.